Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay, last week we discussed the Kalama Sutta. And this week we will take a look at a sutta which is in structure somewhat similar to the Kalama Sutta, though more detailed in the examination of alternative views. This is the Appanaka Sutta, which is number 60 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And the title is translated The Incontrovertible Teaching. The title, the key word in the title, Appanaka, the exact derivation is somewhat uncertain, but the way it's generally used in the text, it seems to indicate that the meaning is what is certain, sure, definite, safe. What's, according to the commentary, it means free from ambiguity or equivocation, let's say free from equivocation, something guaranteeing a safe outcome. And this sutta, like the Kalama Sutta, opens when the Buddha has been wandering through the country together with a large number of monks. And this time he arrives at a Brahmin village in the state of Kosala named Sala. Then the Brahmin householders here, the people who populate this village, are Brahmins who serve as householders. They might work at different occupations, but they belong to the Brahmin caste. And so the report comes to the Brahmin householders that the recluse or ascetic Gotama from the Sakyan clan has been wandering in the Kosalan country, and now he's arrived at our village. Then they hear this good report about this ascetic or recluse named Gotama, that he is said to be an arahant, an accomplished one, fully enlightened, and so forth. We read this passage last week in connection with the Kalama Sutta, so we don't have to go through it again. But they decide that they will go to see him to learn what he has to say, and then they arrive, some pay homage to him. These are the ones who already have some faith in the Buddha. Others politely exchange greetings with him. Others give the anjali, reverential salutation, and sit down. And then the skeptics and cynics, they just remain silent and sit to one side. Then when they're seated, the Buddha asks them whether they are following any particular teaching, whether they have some teacher in whom they have placed faith and confidence with supporting reasons for that confidence. And so they say that they have no teacher that they've taken as being their master or guru, nobody in whom they've established faith. And so now the Buddha doesn't set out to convert them to his teaching. He doesn't try to convince them or even proclaim or expound to them the special features of his own doctrine, but he's going to show them what he calls an incontrovertible teaching, that is, a teaching which they can accept as being certain or definite way to achieve their welfare and happiness for a long time. And this incontrovertible teaching will unfold by contrasting different pairs of opposing views. There will be five pairs of opposing views expounded and discussed in the sutra. Okay, the first opposing view or pairs of views to be discussed is the contrast between what is called the doctrine of nihilism and its opposite is the doctrine of affirmation. In Pali, what's translated nihilism is called Natikavada. And its opposite is Atikavada. Natikavada comes from the verb nati, which means there is not. Then ka is what transforms that verb into an adjective. Then vada means doctrine. Like we have Theravada, the doctrine of the elders, Vijnanavada, doctrine of consciousness, Madhyamaka is called Shunyavada, doctrine of emptiness, Advaitavada, doctrine of non-duality. So all Indian philosophical doctrines are called vadas. Okay, and during the time of the Buddha, the old religious tradition of the Vedas had been losing its cogency, and especially amongst the communities of wandering ascetics, various radical and sometimes disturbing views were beginning to take root and to gradually gain followers. And one of these disturbing, sort of revolutionary views was that of the nihilists, who still adopted lives of celibacy and simplicity, of homeless wandering, but the doctrines that they expounded seemed to be undermining the very basis or foundations for any kind of spiritual life. So this is the doctrine that they expounded. Here we're in paragraph 5 of the sutta. Okay, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this: there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. Here, we don't take this too literally. It doesn't mean that when one person gives something to another that nothing has been given. But what they mean, as we'll see, is that there is no wholesome karma created by giving, that the act of giving will not generate any kind of merit with the potential to bring pleasant fruits in a future life. That there is no fruit or result of good and bad actions. In other words, all the actions that we do, just they exist as long as we are performing them, and once the action is finished, it doesn't deposit any kind of karmic potential in the mind, able to bring good and bad fruits in the future. There's no this world, no other world. Of course, when they say no this world, it doesn't mean that they're denying the existence of this world. What they mean is that for beings in other realms, that there's no such thing as this world existing in contrast to some other world. In other words, this is the only life we live, this is the only world, but there's no world beyond this, no world, no other realms of existence into which beings can be reborn. No mother, no father. This doesn't mean that they're denying a very simple biological fact, but what they mean by this is that there's no merit, no value in serving one's mother and father, no point in paying respects to parents and helping them. The idea seems to be that everybody should be independent, autonomous, people should look after themselves first and not even care for their parents. There are no beings who are reborn spontaneously. That is, the mainstream Indian spirituality at this time recognized various types of beings who take rebirth without going through a slow and gradual process of rebirth, of being born, but they arise in their respective realms spontaneously, just coming full-fledged into existence. These are the beings in the heavenly realms, the hell realms. And so they deny the existence of any beings who are reborn spontaneously. And they say that there are no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare the nature of this world and the other world. In other words, they're saying that even though there might be people wandering about with simple clothing, living on the alms and offerings of others, and practicing meditation, but they have no higher knowledge or higher realization of any kind of truths about the real nature of this world or about the existence of other worlds. From the standpoint of these philosophers, such ascetics and Brahmins are merely either they're humbug or they're just naive fools. And there's a continuation of this view in a different sutta. This is on page 619. It's in sutta number 76. 619. Here we get an abbreviated form of the view. But the view continues. Page 619, paragraph 7. You see, we start off, the view starts off the same way we have it here, down to declare this world and the other world. Then it continues. A person consists of the four great elements. That is, what we call a human being is just a combination of material elements. The four elements recognized by Indian philosophers of that time were the earth, it's the solid element, the liquid element, the heat element, and the vibrational element, what we call earth, water, fire, and air. And so a person comes into existence just through the union of the parents. Before that, there's nothing, no principle of consciousness that the new being inherits. In other words, this is what we call a stark materialism, philosophical materialism. So when the sperm and the egg unite, then the material physical organism takes shape, arises and takes shape. That physical organism is constituted out of the four elements. And as it grows, it increases in size. But the person himself really essentially consists only in the physical organism. Mind or consciousness, these are just like, call them bubbles on the surface of water. Like if we have a mass of water and we stir it up, bubbles arise and the bubbles seem to be something real, almost independent. But before long, the bubbles just break up, and what remains when the bubbles break up is the water. So we say the water is real. The bubbles are just manifestations of the water. And so for these thinkers, matter, physical matter is real. Mind, consciousness, just byproducts of matter. Maybe to use a more high-tech image, it's just like we have a computer, maybe you have flicking through the screen on the computer, you're seeing maybe a whole encyclopedia you could flick through, and it seems like all of this information is coming from the computer, but you turn off the electricity and what's there? It's just a hunk of physical components. no intelligence. People think of computers having memory, intelligence, but all of that is just electronic processes which we are projecting these terms onto the physical instrument, the computer. And so in the same way, these thinkers, these philosophers would say, what we are just physical, biological processes, and mind and consciousness is just a byproduct or something superimposed or arising fortuitously out of the physical processes. And so when a person, continuing now with the text here on page 619, when a person dies, then this combination of the four elements breaks apart. And the earth returns and goes back to the body of earth, to the universal earth element. The liquid in the body, that returns to the mass of the water element, the inanimate water element, the water of nature. The fire, the heat of the body, that just gets dissipated into space, becomes part of the universal heat element. The air of our breathing, when exhales that final breath when death takes place, and then all of the air of the body, all of the gases in the body disintegrates, all the gases get released and merge into the atmosphere. And the faculties, the sense faculties, somehow they just disappear into space. Then four men carry the coffin. They carry away the corpse in the coffin, bring it to the charnel ground. In those days, they would burn the bodies, cremate them. And the... the funeral orations last as far as the charnel ground. That is, when they're bringing the body there, they're making speeches praising the virtues of the dead man. Before they actually set fire to the body, his friends and relatives praise him. He was a wonderful man, great man, rich in virtues, and so on. Then they burn the body, go back home, and they think, what's to eat? What's to drink? What's on television? And so the bones whitened. That's when the bones are burnt. First they turn black. Then as the flames consume them, then they turn white. And burnt offerings end with ashes. I guess the sense here is just that the body ends in ashes. And so the doctrine of giving, that there's some value in giving, merit in giving, for this thinker, this is a doctrine of fools. This is the kind of person who thinks, why give? You only have this one life to live. Keep what you get. Enjoy life. Use whatever you've earned, your hard-earned money, use it to get things for yourself. But don't think you're going to get some merit from giving things to others. Don't think it's going to lead you to some happiness in the next life. That's just a lot of nonsense that you hear from the priests in order for them to maintain their own standard of living. They also, they want to get their 2 cents also out of this. So they tell you to practice giving. And so when anyone asserts the doctrine that there is giving, some existence after death, some good and bad actions, bringing their good and bad fruits, value in looking after one's parents, and so on, all of this is empty, false prattle. Fools and the wise are alike cut off and annihilated with the dissolution of the body. After death, they do not exist. So one man might devote his life to study, to acquiring what he thinks is wisdom, to reflection, meditation. Another man just thinks he's going to enjoy life. He devotes himself to pursuing sensual pleasures, to taking it easy, to maybe playing practical tricks on others in order to get some laughs for himself. And both of them, when death comes, that's the end for both of them. Nothing survives. And then, okay, that is the view of those who hold that there is nothing given. Then, now we come to paragraph B, back to Sutta 60, paragraph 6. And now there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of these other recluses and Brahmins. And they say, there is what is given, there is what is offered, there is what is sacrificed. In other words, when you give, when you offer things to others, and here sacrificing is not animal sacrificing, but the Buddha uses it pretty much as a synonym for giving in charity. So what this sentence means is that there are merits in practicing generosity, that this action of this practice of generosity creates wholesome karma with the power to bring good results in the future. And so there is fruit and result of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. In other words, there are these two basic domains between which beings transmigrate or reincarnate from one world to the next world, from the other world back to this world. There is mother and father. There is value in serving and respecting one's parents. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously in some of these other realms of existence. And there are good, virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have themselves realized directly, by direct knowledge, the true nature of this world and the other world, and explain them to others, declare them to others. Okay, so we have this contrast between these two opposing views now, directly contradicting each other. Okay, now the Buddha is going to take them up for examination. And first he takes the nihilistic view, that there is nothing given and so on. And so he says, of those ascetic recluses and Brahmins who hold this doctrine that there is nothing given, it is to be expected that they will avoid these three wholesome states, namely, good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and good mental conduct, and that they will undertake and practice these three unwholesome states or unwholesome types of actions, namely, bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct. And what is the reason for that? Because these good recluses and Brahmins do not see in unwholesome states the danger, the degradation and defilement, and they do not see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, that is, the blessing of renouncing the unwholesome states, getting rid of them, and cleansing oneself of unwholesome modes of behavior. Okay, so first, let us put this schematically on the board. Okay, so first the Buddha has drawn this consequence out by the statement of the view. That's what I've already discussed, the actual statement of the nihilistic view that comes in paragraph 5. now we are examining it. So the first point that's drawn out is that it leads to undesirable consequence in its effect. It has an undesirable consequence in its effect on behavior or conduct, because it leads to unwholesome behavior of body, speech, and mind. Okay, and now we come to paragraph 8. The Buddha draws out further consequences of holding this view of nihilism. And here, at the beginning of this paragraph, he departs somewhat from his strategy in the Kalama Sutta, where he keeps his view pretty much privately to himself. Here he actually lays his cards out on the table and explains or states the way things appear to himself as a Buddha. He says, since there actually is another world, one who holds the view there is no other world has wrong view. Okay, so the first consequence is that it leads to, but this proposition, this doctrine itself, is a wrong view. The assertion that there is no other world, no results or fruits of good and bad actions. Okay, and when one forms intentions on the basis of this view that there is no other world, then one's intentions, one's plans, one's volitions will be wrong intention. And since there actually is another world, one who makes the statement, who declares there is no other world, is at fault for wrong speech. And since there actually is another world, one who says there is no other world is opposed to the arahants, the liberated ones, like the Buddha himself, who know the other world, who have seen it and experienced it. Okay, so these are private consequences that arise from this declaration, from holding and propagating this view. But when one is propagating it, then if one convinces another person to accept the idea that there is no other world and no consequences of action, then one is convincing that person to accept untrue Dhamma, something which is false Dhamma, false teaching. And then because he convinces another to accept an untrue doctrine, then when he succeeds, then he praises himself and disparages others. And so any pure virtues that he previously had are abandoned and his conduct becomes corrupted. And so as a result of this wrong view, holding this wrong view that there is no other world, there arise wrong view, that is the wrong view itself one has taken hold of, one forms wrong intention, one utters wrong speech, one opposes the noble ones, the enlightened ones. One converts others to untrue teaching, to false doctrine. And one praises oneself and disparages or condemns others. So let's mark this. Thank you. Okay, but now in paragraph 8, the Buddha has explained his point of view from the standpoint, he's speaking from the standpoint of one who actually sees and knows that there is another world and that there are results of karmic action. But now in paragraph 9, the Buddha shows how a wise person who doesn't yet have the certainty of the existence of another world might reflect and reason in order to find the right course to follow. And here we take a person who is concerned, seriously concerned for his own long-term welfare and benefit, but who's not yet ready to place faith in a spiritual teacher who teaches the existence of another world and of the reality of the law of karma and its fruit. So this is, we call, a very cautious, pragmatic approach to this question. Of course, we have to consider that this person in the sutta is coming from Indian society in which there was already a certain pre-established worldview to which most people adhered. Things will be quite different today. But this is the way the wise man reflects. He considers, if there is no other world, then on the dissolution of the body, that is, with the death of the body, this person, the one who's following that view, will have made himself safe enough. That is, he's safe because he's enjoyed himself in this life. Maybe he's violated all the rules of morality, but he's enjoyed himself, had a lot of fun, used his wealth to get whatever pleasures life can offer. Now he's dead, gone, completely vanished. So he's made himself safe enough that there's no, he's not been reborn in any plane of misery. But if there is another world, then on the dissolution of the body after death, things, life is not over for this person. But if he really behaves wrongly on the basis of those views, of his views, then he will be reborn in a state of misery, in an unhappy destination, in the lower realms. He might even give up the human form and take rebirth in the animal realm, or even in the lowest realm, hell. Okay, but let's put aside now, he says, let's put aside the question whether the word of these teachers, these good recluses and Brahmins, is true. But let's go along with them and assume that there is no other world. Still, this good person is here and now censured by the wise as an immoral person, one of wrong view, whose they call him a nihilist. Now, today, if somebody just has no concern for future life, no concern for practicing, observing morality, but just tries to enjoy himself, most people think, ah, he's a jolly good fellow. As long as he doesn't go around inflicting a lot of harm on others. And if he does inflict harm on others without, not in too gruesome a way, but he manages to get away with it, people still think he's a clever fellow, one who's rather cold and indifferent to others, but still he's been quite successful in life. And maybe many people will praise him and even emulate him. And also I have to say, express my own opinion, that nowadays also there are many people who hold the view that there is no life after death, that there's no results of one's good and bad actions continuing on in some form after death. But still, they will uphold strong ethical standards. They'll adopt strong ethical, high ethical standards, and they will try to live to the, up to the higher standards of ethics. So it seems that the belief in an afterlife is not a necessary condition for living an ethical life. In fact, I think quite a large number of people today don't accept the existence of an afterlife, but still take certain moral principles as the basis for regulating their own lives and their relationships to others. But in the Indian society of the Buddha's day, almost everybody who had any kind of inclination towards goodness, towards a wholesome spiritual way of life, would have affirmed the existence of a life after death. So when somebody appears on the scene declaring that there is no life after death, no results of good and bad actions, this person is considered really an instigator of trouble, a rebel against the prevailing worldview, somebody who is virtually a heretic who's seeking to undermine the very ethical norms that keep society together. Okay, so against the backdrop of this period, this person who rejects the existence of an afterlife and who behaves according to his own whims, who violates all of the standards of right conduct, the wise people will criticize and blame this person as being an immoral person. They call him dusila. These Indian words are very, the Pali words are very rich in meaning. In English, they don't quite come across in the same way. They say that he's dusila. Like even in Sri Lanka, when they refer to somebody as dusila, it means, in effect, it implies don't associate with that person, keep a distance from him. He's a michadittiko, one of wrong view, michadristi. So it's like a person of wrong view, it's the person that one keeps a distance from, that one doesn't want to associate with. It's like if you hear, okay, this person has been a child molester, nowadays you would keep a distance from that person. This person has been in jail for killing his wife, then he's out. Well, if he's been in jail, maybe he won't come out. But okay, this has been a bank robber. Well, maybe a bank robber, you would want to get friendly with him. A petty thief, okay, if you hear the person's a pickpocket or a petty thief, then you keep a distance from him. And he's a nihilist, natika, nastika. Do you know that word? It's even today it's used in India. If somebody is a nastika, it means he's a heretic, a sinner, virtually the same as a sinner. And the Brahmins and later the Hindus designated the Buddhists as being Nastikas because they didn't believe in the existence of an Atman, a soul, or in the existence of Ishvara, the creator God. And they didn't accept the validity of the Vedas. Okay, so whether or not the word of these philosophers is true, if there's no other world, still this person is condemned by the wise. On the other hand, if there is another world, then this good person, and here I should explain, good person is just a polite phrase, and it doesn't mean that he's actually good, but it's just a polite phrase. Bhavang Puriso, I think it is, has made an unlucky throw on both counts. That is, he is censored by the wise here and now. The wise people blame him, dismiss him as a nastika, a nihilist, a dusila, a moral person. And on the dissolution of the body after death, he has to face the consequences. He's reborn in the state of misery, an unhappy destination, in the lower realms, even in hell. And so he has wrongly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends only to one side, and excludes the wholesome alternative. I understand, this is the way I would understand the expression, the phrase, that extends only to one side. That is, the point is that he is safe from an unhappy rebirth only if there is no afterlife. But by accepting this doctrine, he excludes the wholesome alternative. That is, he rejects the view that there is an afterlife, that there are results of actions, and that would be the alternative that leads to wholesome or desirable consequences. That is, he excludes everything entailed by a belief in an afterlife, right view, right intention, right speech, and so on. Okay, so let me just complete this. Can everybody see everything? Okay, now we'll take the other side of the coin. Okay, now we come to the other side of the coin. This is what's called the view of affirmation, Atikavada, the view which accepts the idea of future lives, or at least a future life, and of the result of action, karmic result of action. We come now, we're in paragraph 10, bottom of 508. Okay, so of those ascetics and Brahmins who hold this doctrine that there is results of actions, that there is a future life, it is to be expected that they will avoid the three unwholesome states, that is, bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct. But maybe before we go into this, maybe I should ask if there are any questions on the examination of the nihilistic view. If you do have questions, please, or comments, don't hesitate. No.
Yeah. That would seem to kind of fall outside personal gains.
You mean people who don't have belief in future life but still try to behave selflessly?
Right.
Yeah, that's I think that's what I brought up when I said that today it seems that in some respect that this does not necessarily hold today, at least. It holds for a lot, but there are cases of, I know of cases of many people, I mean, who don't believe or don't believe strongly in an afterlife and are not motivated to do good actions because they want to get rewards in some form in a future life. But they just find it to correspond to their ethical ideal, their spiritual ideal, to behave selflessly for the good of others. And so they will engage in many good actions, philanthropy, do whatever they can to benefit others, sometimes even sacrifice their own life, but without any concern whether there will be good results in a future life.
But can we say that these people actually, due to their wholesome roots from their past, that's why they are able to act in such a way?
Yeah.
Only that their views are not affirm in such a way that they're able to identify with what we call the true Dharma.
Yeah, that is a good point. Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, can we just assume that there's no cause and effect, cause or condition in which that person is acting in such a philanthropic way?
It seems that what is really being pinpointed here in the sutra are those people who go around propagating the view that there is no future life, no existence, no fruits of good and bad actions, as an intentional way of undermining the foundations of ethics, kind of they're in a state of perhaps even rebellion against mainstream religion of society. They want to be the provocateurs, yeah. Yes. It's quite possible that this is an honest belief that they've worked out, say, that these thinkers through their own reasoning. But if they propagate these views, if they hold these views and see that an implication of these views is that it doesn't matter whether one behaves in wholesome ways or unwholesome ways, then perhaps they will be more likely to be led by the unwholesome tendencies of the mind to behave in unwholesome ways, to engage in wrong conduct of body, speech, and mind. And then they will also, as described in this text, they propagate their views to others. And so they lead others who might have previously accepted the ideas of an afterlife, of the importance of following ethical ways of behavior, they will lead them astray into wrong patterns of behavior.
But can they be blamed for it if it's an honest opinion?
It's not a matter of us, well, actually, according to the Sutta, the wise people will blame them. Yes, I think that they should be blamed for this. If they take these views as implying that one could behave in destructive, detrimental ways detrimental to the well-being of others. Just like, okay, somebody might take the view, maybe it's an opinion that he's worked out quite honestly through his own reflection, that, all foreign immigrants to the United States should be, they don't have any place in this country, so they should be eliminated. And so he goes around, maybe he takes it upon himself to pick up a rifle and to go around to any neighbors who have immigrated to this country from abroad and starts shooting them. Now this is his honest opinion. And even if he just keeps it as an opinion that they should be, without shooting them, but holds the opinion they should be evicted, they should be kicked out, they weren't born here, why should they be living here? So the fact that he arrives at it honestly through his own reflection doesn't mean that the opinion is in any way free, blameless, not worthy of condemnation, right? Am I bound to the 8 o'clock?
You're the boss.
Shifu, blame me? I know he keeps a very precise time schedule.
Good.
Because I know some people drive here from quite some distance away, so I want to make sure.
Ask the audience. Yeah. Whether it's okay.
Is it okay to go on about 10, 15 more minutes?
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure the people who come from far away get their money's worth. Get their gasoline's worth. Okay, so let us now do we call the bright side of the teaching. Okay, so we take those who have come, ascetics and Brahmins who hold the view that there is an afterlife, that there are results of action, and it is to be expected that they will avoid these three unwholesome states, namely bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct, and that they will undertake and practice these three wholesome states, namely good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and good mental conduct. Well, the text says it's expected, but I have to say I've heard of many prominent religious figures of different religions, whether Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, including Buddhist monks, who supposedly believe in the existence of an afterlife and the fruits of action, and they don't always avoid the three unwholesome types of action. And they don't always undertake the three wholesome types of action. But we could assume that those who hold this view seriously and reflect deeply on its consequences will abstain from the unwholesome behavior and adopt wholesome ways of behavior. And why is that? Because these good rikusas and brahmins see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation, and defilement. These are the ones who will avoid the unwholesome actions. When they see that there's danger in unwholesome behavior, that they're degrading and defiling to one's character. And they will see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, of giving up the unwholesome, and of cleansing the mind, cleansing one's spiritual being. Has everybody gotten this so I can erase? Actually, this is me. What do you call this? Affirmationism? Oh, sorry. It has effect on conduct. Avoid unwholesome body, speech, and mind actions, and one takes up wholesome. Okay, then in paragraph 11, the Buddha lays his cards on the table. He's speaking now from his point of view as an enlightened one. Since there actually is another world, one who holds the view there is another world has right view, and when he forms his plans, his intentions, when he engages in motivated action on the basis of that view, then his intentions are right intentions. And when he declares that there is another world and so on, then he is uttering right speech. And since there is actually another world, one who says so is not contradicting the arahants who know the other world. And when he convinces another person there is another world, then he is leading him into true doctrine, to true Dharma. And because he convinces another to accept true Dharma, he does not praise himself and disparage others. Well, again, I think I know a number of monks who convert people to, or lead people to Buddhism, or to their version of Buddhism, and then not praise, you see how great I am, what a wonderful preacher I am, and this venerable with his following, no, he's going astray, he's on the wrong track. But we have to assume here that the one who's speaking is somebody of sincerity and upright standards of behavior. Okay, so he does not praise himself and disparage others, and thus his corrupt conduct is abandoned and he develops pure virtue. And so we have as consequences of his right view, of the view that there is another world, that he adopts right view, right intention, right speech. And do you recognize these qualities? Do they belong to anything that you are familiar with? Eightfold Noble Path, yeah. They're the first three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Then there's not contradicting, not opposing the noble ones, leading others into the true Dharma, and avoiding self-praise and disparagement of others with that, in brackets with my little footnote, yeah. Well, he's contradicting them. I wouldn't say that he's disparaging them.
Looking a little further, it seems to me that if you believe that there are fruits,
yeah,
the wholesome actions,
yeah,
he wouldn't disparage for that
reason.
Yeah. Of the negative speech.
Yeah, he wouldn't disparage in the sense of putting them down and saying, don't listen to that person. Well, he might say, of course he would say, don't listen to that person, but you say, that person is an utter fool. Actually, the Buddha sometimes does speak of others. Well, let's say that...
degrading their moral, their value, yeah, their character.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Sort of besmirching them, you could say. The point is not to besmirch their persons, their personalities, but to be firmly and staunchly rejecting their views. What the Buddha says in another sutta, he says, you criticize the Dhamma, but not the person as a person. Reject the Dhamma, but don't reject the person. Or maybe it was Gandhi's statement, you hate the sin, but not the sinner. Okay, now... right view. Ah, right, good, good. Okay, now that was what the Buddha was saying, speaking from his point of view. But in paragraph 12, he explains how the wise man reflects. And he considers, if there is another world, then on the dissolution of the body after death, this good person, the one who follows this view, will be reborn in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. Okay, now whether or not the word of those good ascetic recluses and Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no other world. Still, this good person is here and now praised by the wise as a virtuous person, Silava. Again, it has a very rich meaning in Indian, as the Indian background. One of upright character, a person of integrity. These days we don't generally don't applaud a person as being a virtuous person. Say he's a clever person, skillful person. What other expressions, what kind of person do we praise? Strong-minded person, strong-willed person. Okay, one with right view, he has samaditti. And he's an attika, one who holds the doctrine of affirmation. Okay, but now on the other hand, if there is, okay, so if there's no other world, then this person, he's behaved in wholesome ways. He doesn't get the reward of a good rebirth, but still he's a respected member of society. The wise hold him in esteem, and he's honored. Praised by the wise. But if there is another world, then this good person has made a lucky throw on both counts. Here the metaphor is taken from dice, playing dice. Since he is praised by the wise here and now, and then after death, he gets his reward in the next life, a happy rebirth, even in heaven. So this person has rightly accepted and untaken this undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends to both sides. That is, he gets both benefits, the benefit here and now, whether or not there is another life. And if there is another life, then he gets also the benefit of a happy rebirth after death. And it excludes the unwholesome alternative. That is, by taking up this view that there is the fruit of action, there is another life, he, by adopting that view, he will avoid unwholesome types of behavior. Okay, maybe that is enough for this evening. If there are any questions, any comments, please feel welcome. Yeah, Suki. Yeah, I would understand it in that sense. Here, for the wise person who's reflecting thus, this is not necessarily somebody who's becoming a renunciant in the sense of a monk or a nun, but just, I think it's the giving up of the unwholesome states, unwholesome views, and the unwholesome types of action that they entail. I think it's quite remarkable how the Buddha reflects, considers these topics in such minute detail, taking each aspect and going through in such rigorous logical sequence. Considering this is 400 BC, 500 BC. But this seems to be a kind of ancient, precursor of what's called Pascal's wager. Pascal was I think 17th century French philosopher who, on the one hand, he had a sort of deep religious faith and belief in God, but on the other hand, he was tormented by doubts caused by the rise of the new science, and he was a mathematician, and so he was caught in this constant conflict between his attraction towards religious faith and doubt and skepticism. And so he sort of made up what's called the wager that, and of course according to the Catholic faith, the Catholic doctrine, if you have faith, if you believe, then your salvation is guaranteed. If you don't believe, then you are, even if you're a good person, you're condemned to hell. And so he reason that if I don't believe, even though I might get all sorts of other worldly benefits and be able to succeed in life and whatever I do, still living a virtuous life, but because I don't believe the doctrine of the church, then I will be condemned to eternity in hell. Whereas if I believe, even though the belief might be completely contrary to my reason, I will be given the reward of eternal life in heaven. That is, if there is a God. Yeah.
It doesn't seem like you would be getting full virtue from people if they're just thinking, well, a better place, safe on the safe side, and, I don't feel like doing anything good, but...
Yeah. I mean, that's true. I agree with that 100%.
That wager.
Yeah.
Wager.
Yeah.
And because it's a gamble. And I'm being very logical. And I give the charity. Well, I force myself to.
Yeah. But I think maybe this is sort of line of reasoning is sort of following from what you take the minimal requirement to be on the safe side. Yeah. It's not that the Buddha is going to end here and say that one should just be engaging in wholesome actions because that will bring some rewards in the next life, or because you'll be praised by wise people in this life. Yeah. No, there are different layers of motivation And so now the Buddha is maybe taking what we may call a minimal motivation for entering upon wholesome actions.
It was my impression from hearing this that he was attempting to undermine their stability in any nihilist thoughts they might have been having.
These people that he was addressing?
Yes.
Yeah, quite
possibly. If they had any nihilist thoughts, he was just attempting to break that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So that he could then reach in with the Dhamma and fill in the gaps with the
Buddha. At least to establish in them what you might call the minimum of right view as the motivation for, you say, right action, right speech, right thought.
Well, what strikes me about this Sutta is we consider ourselves so modern.
Yeah.
Because this modern science, you know, materialism. Nihilism comes from modern science. We've built machines, we've built robots, and we think that this is such a modern view to have. And here we see they were arguing about this. Nothing new.
Even in Greece too, there were similar views being promulgated by the skeptics, the materialists. Okay, I think we should stop now. Are there any people new here who didn't get the syllabus, the scheme of reading?